Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
Support for KUAF comes from Edible Ozarkansas. This quarterly magazine focuses on food, farms, and culture of the Ozarks. Proceeds benefit hunger relief efforts through Feed Fayetteville and Feed Communities. More information, including subscriptions, available at edibleozarkansas.com.
Ahead on Weekend Ozarks, we'll hear wedding bells in our Sunday morning montage, and we'll talk about talking about faith.
That and more, but first. A longtime downtown Fayetteville business is ending its tenure on Dixon Street. After nearly a decade and a half in the same location, Sydney's Emporium is moving. And while the business, known for its tie-dye, isn't going far, some changes are afoot for the store. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis visited the store in its final days in the old UARC Theater building. Here is his report.
Sid Simon's store wasn't always on Dixon Street, nor has it always focused on tie-dyed clothing. When he first opened a business of his own in the mid-1980s, it was actually focused on screen printing, but when the advent of computers changed the dynamics of the business, Sid decided to take another route.
At the time, a friend of mine who's, I believe she lives in Eureka Springs now, Francesca Garcia, she was tie-dyeing in a little space on Block Avenue there where a World Treasures is now, and she was interested in learning how to screen print, and I wanted to learn to tie-dye, so we worked together, and she taught me and several other people in town how to tie-dye, and several of those people went on to do nothing but that, and they still do.
He says that, as opposed to the expensive equipment needed for screen printing, all one needed for tie-dye was a washing machine, a clothes dryer, and a table to get started. When he focused solely on dyeing shirts in 1987, Simon says that retro music and clothing of the 60s and 70s began to make a resurgence.
Tie-dye just really, even though it never really just went away, it started coming back more with kind of mainstream America. Francesca and I had done some Grateful Dead tours together, and we took tie-dyes to shows and discovered that even though there were lots and lots of other tie-dye for sale there, you know, we could make money at it, and it was just a lot of fun. So we did that for a while, and then along the way we would buy other things to sell along with the tie-dyes, like stickers and jewelry and things.
But when the Dead wasn't on tour, he and Francesca started selling shirts to friends and even began selling on consignment to stores like Sound Warehouse and a few other stores around town. As word of mouth got around about Sydney's shirts, Sid and his partner decided to start opening up during regular hours to sell dyed clothing and other merchandise they would sell when touring around the country. But around 1991, Sydney split with his business partner and moved from Block Street. He rented a space at 412 Dixon, which is now home to Common Grounds.
And at that time, that whole block was just like a ghost town. Most of the buildings were closed and boarded up. The rent was cheap.
He says that at that time, he paid about $400 a month in rent. But that was the early 90s, and rent didn't stay that inexpensive on Dixon Street for long.
Usually, as several other businesses around town, I keep running from either the building sells or the rent gets raised, and so this will be my sixth move.
After leaving the space at 412 Dixon, Simons moved the business to the space that was then known as the Green Warehouse. Once home to Ozark Natural Foods, it is now the site of the Legacy Building. He later moved into the original Schulertown and eventually ended up at what was known as the Boardwalk in the mid-90s. Today, it's known as the UARC Bowl, and that's where Sydney met Leroy Pierce.
He had a space open inside what was the former bowling alley. He had turned it into a mini mall with little shops for rent, but much more reasonable rent. I didn't mention that the Schulertown was very expensive for what you got, so Leroy was a lifesaver for me.
Sid says that the affordable rent at the Boardwalk made it possible for mom-and-pop operations to give the retail business a try. Fast forward a few years to March of 2000. Decades Clothing had moved out of the old UARC theater space, and Leroy Pierce owned that building as well. So Sydney moved across the street, but it was about that time that the city began revitalizing Dixon Street, with new sidewalks, curb and guttering, and other beautification measures. Sydney says that as construction went on, business was slow as foot traffic tended to stay away from Dixon. Business did slowly come back, first with college students and later with customers from around the area. But over time, Sydney says that the price of rent has risen to the point where he had to make a choice.
I knew that this day would come, and I think that the owners think that they can get closer to what the perceived value of Dixon Street square footage is. So I don't have to move out. I could stay. A property manager actually is the one who I deal with now, and I don't deal with the Pierce Family Trust. But the rent has gone up a few times in the last 4 years, but this time it went up triple what I've been paying.
So once again, Sydney started looking for a new location for his business.
Then I was driving down College after just coming back from looking at a strip space out on Township, and I saw one of the Airstreams had a for rent sign on it there at the yacht club. So I pulled into there and called the phone number, and the woman who owns it met me there, and I said, I'll take it.
But to fit the business into an Airstream trailer, Sydney says some changes are necessary, namely that the new location won't carry as much of some types of merchandise.
Like clothing and home decor, things like that, but we'll still have tie-dye, which is, you know, what the whole thing was founded and based on, and we'll have just the big selling items, and on nice days it will be an outdoor market. I think it's just has potential to be the next new cool hip thing in town.
And he's not alone. Cynthia Morris is the owner of the Yacht Club on College. She says that while Sydney isn't the first retail shop to set up at the Yacht Club, she's excited because it's different than those other previous offerings.
All of my other retail shops have really been geared to 20 and 30 year old young women. And Sydney's coming down, being a large store, coming down to a smaller store. On nice days, he's going to put out racks and tables, put out his tie-dyed t-shirts that I like to say, I think he's been selling them since they were popular the first time. And they're going to be colorful, and people can walk over and shop with Sydney while they're eating.
If it seems like Sydney's emporium moving into the Yacht Club is counter to logic, you're not wrong. The Yacht Club has been touted as a launching pad for mom-and-pop shops to give their ideas a go in the marketplace, and a handful of businesses have grown up into brick-and-mortar locations. But Sydney's is the first business to move from a brick-and-mortar location to the Yacht Club. Morris says that Sydney's situation is indeed unique.
He has signed a 6-month lease with me. We'll see how that works out for him. You know, we may be just an in-between step for him. I don't know. I don't know if he'll find then he'll want to go to a strip shopping center, or if he will just go totally on the internet. That's up to him. But I love that we can give people other options that are not available at all out there. I'm sure the brick-and-mortar landlords, they do not want to get into 90-day or 6-month leases. So we're kind of unique that people can try out an idea and see how it works.
As for what Sydney will miss most about the location where his business has been for 14 years?
I don't know. The building, there's something about it. I don't know if it's feng shui or if it's there's something about the building. Now, you know, picking up this business and moving it into like a strip center out on Weddington or something, I don't know if that would work. You know, I looked at places like that, and I think that not only the location, but just the building itself has a lot to do with the appeal.
But what the future holds for the old UARC Theater building is anyone's guess. Only time will tell if it's restored into a movie house, converted into a music venue, or something else completely different. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Late last month, the University of Arkansas celebrated Peabody Hall's 100th birthday. The now century-old building reopened in 2011 after undergoing a restoration process. The recent celebration inspired Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda to learn more about the building's namesake for our What's in a Name series, and she has this report.
It seems fitting that Peabody Hall is the home of the College of Education and Health Professions at the University of Arkansas. Years ago, university students got hands-on experience teaching children in Peabody Elementary School and University High School, which were once housed in Peabody Hall. The stately red brick building sits just north of the old main lawn on the northeast corner of the university's main campus. Last month, current and former students, as well as university officials, gathered on Peabody's South Lawn to celebrate the building's centennial. Fayetteville's mayor was among those in attendance.
Now, therefore, I, Lionel Jordan, mayor of the city of Fayetteville, Arkansas, do hereby proclaim Friday, April 25th, 2014, as Peabody Hall 100th Anniversary Day in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and I call upon all citizens to celebrate this significant anniversary with the University of Arkansas community. Thank you.
Over the last decade, new buildings have been added to the university campus and older ones have been updated. Chancellor David Gerhart says Peabody Hall is one of only five buildings on campus that were built prior to 1925.
As such, it is an integral part of our campus identity. It's an integral part of our character and our heritage. Built in 1913 with $40,000 in private funds, from the Peabody Education Foundation, Peabody Hall has the distinction of being the first building on campus created with private funds. Now, I will tell you, it cost us a little more than $40,000 to renovate it a couple of years ago. But for more than 50 years, it was the site of the Peabody Elementary School and, as you know, the University High School. Perhaps its most famous graduate was University of Arkansas President and United States Senator J. William Fulbright, who attended kindergarten through high school here. He used to tell people it took him 17 years to get out of the University of Arkansas. Now that this building has been restored to its original red brick, it looks much more like the home that he knew growing up.
Peabody Hall is named for the man whose money financed its construction, George Peabody, the father of modern philanthropy. The City of Peabody, Massachusetts, the Peabody Institute Library, the Peabody Historical Society, and the George Peabody House have worked together to create a website with online exhibits of the city's past. According to the website, which can be found at peabodymassarchives.com, George Peabody was born February 18, 1795, in South Danvers, Massachusetts, which today is called Peabody, Massachusetts. He was born poor and received little formal education, but by the age of 19, he went into the import and export business. In 1837, he traveled to London to expand his work and eventually became an investment banker. Tim Nutt is the head of special collections at University of Arkansas Libraries. He was asked to do some research on George Peabody in preparation for last month's celebration. The U of A benefited from the philanthropist's decision to create the Peabody Education Fund.
He wanted to encourage the intellectual, moral, and industrial education of the destitute children of the southern states. So after the Civil War, you know, he saw this need in the southern United States to improve the lives of the children, and he did that through education. And so he set up this fund to create schools, and I just find that that's just amazing. That he would have that forethought and that sense of obligation to help his fellow man.
Nutt says although Peabody had not been born into a rich family, he managed to pull himself up by his own bootstraps and create a nice life for himself. Nutt says he thinks Peabody's background helped influence his philanthropic decisions as an adult.
It wasn't just the southern states. I mean, he contributed so many things across the country and London, as I mentioned. He gave to Harvard University, he gave to Yale University, he gave to his hometown in Massachusetts. And it all has to do with education. So obviously he saw the need for education and how education could lift you out of out of being poor or destitute and get you a better life.
George Peabody donated more than $8 million to his hometown, as well as several colleges, libraries, and museums. He was the first American to be named an honorary citizen of London, the city where he died in 1869 at the age of 74. He is buried in Salem, Massachusetts, and his birthplace of 205 Washington Street in Peabody, Massachusetts, is now the George Peabody House Museum. Tim Nutt, head of special collections, says it's important to mark anniversaries like the 100th anniversary of Peabody Hall for a number of reasons.
Having that event the other day, celebrating the centennial of Peabody School, and the people there who had been former students and everyone who had memories of Peabody School, I think it's very it's nice just to let people, one, remember, that sounds so cliche, but remember the good times that they had at Peabody School, or whatever it may be. And two, just to educate as well, because people don't know who Peabody School was named after. And there were people, I'm sure there were people at that event the other day who was pleased to learn about the history of Peabody School and who George Peabody was, and to learn more about the history of the campus and the history of Fayetteville. And I think those are one of the things, when you have events like that, educating folks about the history of their community or their state is very important.
For more on the College of Education and Health Professions, which is housed in Peabody Hall, visit coehp.uark.edu. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Yannick Nizet-Seguin conducts the Chamber Orchestra of Europe in the Symphonies of Schumann on a new release for Deutsche Grammophon. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of the KUIF Sunday Symphony, Sunday night, 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KUIF, and now 1 p.m. Sunday afternoons on KUIF 2. Join me for Schumann's Symphonies No. 1 and 4 from the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, led by Yannick Nizet-Seguin.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. If you have spent some time in downtown Fayetteville over the last 2 years, you may have noticed six ominous stick sculptures on Tyson Plaza in front of the Walton Arts Center. Out of the woodwork was constructed from the trunks and limbs of ash saplings by world-renowned artist Patrick Doherty, with the help of over 100 volunteers. When the artworks were constructed in May of 2012 for that year's Artist Fair Festival, the artist and Walton Arts Center officials said they would be pleased if it stayed up until the next year's event. 2 years later, Walton Arts Center enters Artist Fair 2014, and the sticks have come down. But as I found out, they'll still play a role in this year's celebrations.
Hey, Beat Man, you ready?
Yep.
You ready to be the Hunter Beat Man?
The volunteers and the artist who constructed the six-piece stickworks sculpture out of the woodwork are long gone. But three facilities employees of the Walton Arts Center are on hand to ensure it gets properly taken care of. On a sunny spring morning one day last week, they worked in an area of Tyson Plaza in front of Walton Arts Center on West Avenue, just steps south of Dixon, knocking the 16-foot sculptures over, slicing through them with a chainsaw, and tossing them into a mulcher. As Beth Bobbitt, public relations manager with Walton Arts Center, explains, the artist's intent behind more than 200 stickwork sculptures around the globe is to be temporary
and beautiful and iconic, but then to take it down before it gets hazardous. So as you can see, there's one sculpture standing and it's wilting and kind of tearing off in places. And so we do want to make sure and take it down before it gets dangerous. And it's great. You know, we've gotten a lot of questions from the public. Can we relocate? Can we repurpose? And we really can't relocate because, you know, they just don't last that long.
But they can repurpose the sculptures, and they are, by turning it into mulch. Over a two-day period last week, the six gentle giants were turned into 6,000 pounds of mulch, which were then bagged in preparation to be passed out to the community. Beth says the decision to turn it into mulch was just made recently, but was one that fit naturally into the annual Arts and Nature Festival. Exhibiting the cycle of life as something once alive going back into the earth to help build the next tree. And so is the cycle of Artisphere. Across the plaza from the dismantled stickworks that sunny morning last week was a peddler's cart. Painted across the side, the word Enviro Fountain. The work is part of an exhibit for this year's Arts and Nature Festival. Where a peddler's goods would be on display are plants, mosses, and grasses buried into dirt. And the cart? It made a ticking sound. The work is part of a larger exhibit called Enviro Fountains and is the brainchild of Ben Flowers, Luke Knox, and Harry Scott. I met with the artist Ben Flowers at his place of employment, Arcega's at the Depot, which is also a location for one of six Enviro Fountains. Flowers says the sculptures make light of where society sits at the dawn of the age of pervasive computing.
Where we're at right now with like oversaturated media and technology and devices kind of like infiltrating our lifestyle, and how to show like a regrouping of that in a positive light and a new notion of what it can mean to kind of coexist with technology.
As Artisphere is a festival showcasing the collaboration of arts, Enviro Fountains adds in technology. The works use computers to detect social interaction around the works using a microphone. The computer turns whatever feedback it gets from its surroundings into algorithms that are then turned into a water flow. Essentially, it tracks how people are interacting with the space.
In this one, in Arcega's, it's more of an ambient noise from the restaurant below, dictating the development of the garden above. And then in other ones, it's more of a direct experience where you're talking to the devices and watching them water this garden.
Nine boxes hang high above the diners and coffee drinkers. They contain trees, vines, and plants. And as the patrons socialize over the next 6 weeks, Ben expects the plants will grow, filling out the ceiling with green space. The nine boxes are divided into three clusters, each area with its own microphone. He says the placement defines areas of interaction within the restaurant, from the bar space to the main restaurant to a quieter study space in the back. Large blue buckets next to each cluster contain their water that is dispensed through clear plastic hoses. As I visited with Flowers on a relatively quiet midweek afternoon inside the depot, the hum of the restaurant was quite distinct. It's hard to imagine the noise level on a busy weekend evening or morning brunch. I was curious if the plants were at risk of being overwatered as the noise level increases.
They are at risk of so many different things, yeah. And each site, it's a huge challenge of planning with different people to try to come up with what plant is ideal for certain situations. And we've encountered problems there, but it's just this huge learning curve of all of us getting a lot of exposure to these different types of plants. We built the beds in a way to where they can retain water and drain water in certain ways. In this case, it's not possible to drain water to people down beneath them. So we've created these small like reservoir collectors. So runoff water can go into the bottom of them and then we can drain them throughout the progress of this process.
The computers and water devices here are actually on a timer so that the plants can't be overwatered. Ben has a BA in fine arts and drawing and ceramics. And he works here at the depot, which he says allows him to get his hands dirty in his artistic pursuits. But it also helps with collaborating with people.
And that's what this was. It was, you know, this kind of creative community that's been fostered in the Arcega's depot of all of these different artists and, like, creative thinkers working, you know, this kind of hourly wage job to keep their hands free to do creative work, kind of all working towards one vision together. So we had one plant specialist who was an employee here, we had one sign painter who was an employee here, a builder, and then several assistants that all came from this employee group.
Placing the pothos vines, Virginia creeper, and jasmine branches high above the diners seemed a logical place, as it is space-saving and away from the outdoor elements. There are also five other locations in the area that are home to an Enviro Fountain. Each is a little bit different, from the corporate setting to the nonprofit. Each has a different type of space and population, and thus different social interactions. The Fayetteville Underground is an art gallery and a location that people would naturally frequent. Ben says designing for this space was a bit of a challenge, as it is already a destination for art. And there is an expectation for the types of interactions to be had there.
So that one we chose to break the space of the gallery. We created this infinity room through mirror inside of my studio. And so you walk into it and space kind of opens up and feels fluid. And that was one way of dealing with the different type of space and interaction. And really, you know, it doesn't change a whole lot, like the message or the kind of contextualization of it when it changes from like a nonprofit to something corporate. It's really for us like this huge difference in learning experience of how to like interact with these professionals and what kind of planning goes into it in different locations. So that was like a huge learning curve as well.
Ben says as an artist, he has a lot of choices. Is the purpose of the work to compete with the space or to enhance its architecture? As the Walton Arts Center is a high-traffic place with a circulating population and programming, the cart mechanism seemed fitting. He says the work was inspired by the wonder cabinets of Mark Dion and other artists who use moving cabinetry.
And that was just to make use of something, let it be mobile so that they can do what they will with it, utilize it however they choose.
He says the ticking sound the cart makes as it waters was actually a surprise. The artist had a set of expectations to how the devices would work, and sometimes those went unmet.
So then you realize, like, we can adhere them to different materials and they'll make different sounds. If it's hollow or if it's a hard material or a porous material. And that one, we really liked the sound of it, and we knew that it would be outside a large amount of the time. It sounds sort of like Japanese water drums to us. So it was just kind of fun to play with like how the machines make sounds back and kind of create this conversation.
Even if the depot were a quiet space, the devices in these beds were buried in the dirt, leaving little resonance to carry it. But that was the intention, as to not annoy the diners with the ticking heard above. The materials used to make all of the sculptures were largely recycled. Here at the depot, the owners are renovating an old garage on MLK Boulevard in Fayetteville for a new Arcega's location. And the resources for these works came from that building's demolition. The burlap that can be seen through wooden slabs at the bottom of the boxes came from the delivery of green coffee. Now that the sculptures are in place, Ben says they are in a meditation of maintenance, checking in on the works and refilling their water buckets about once a week.
We're taking turns, and my route right now is kind of this all-encompassing, like, feeling like I have six pets that I've left to, like, babysitters all around town, so I feel really like I need to be there. So I'm kind of maintaining them all and making sure alongside our team that we have good notes on this one needs this much water, or, you know, this device needs to be rewatered every 5 days, different things like that. So I'm kind of getting this routine in place now, and then I'll be able to delegate that to all of our volunteers that are all, you know, provided for in this creative community of the Arcega's Depot.
The Enviro Fountains will be on exhibit through the Artisphere Festival and will be removed from their locations at the end of June. And like Stickworks, Ben says the materials will be repurposed, most likely by going into other works of the three artists, which he says will also be reworked into the community. As for artworks of Artisphere's past, Karst, a cob structure, will be removed mid-June, and all materials for that are decomposable. Spiral Wetlands will remain at Lake Fayetteville through the growing season and into November, when the plants will be replanted at other wetland sites. For more information, visit artisphere.festival.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
Good morning. It's Sunday, May 18th, 2014. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And Christina, who is with us?
Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Good morning,
she wins
Becca.
The pop quiz.
That's right.
That's good. That means everybody's eyes are open enough to tell who's here.
That's right.
Did you read science fiction as a kid?
Not really.
I did, yeah.
Yeah. You know who Terry Brooks is then?
Yes.
The author of Sword of Shannara. We all read that in the 70s. If we were reading it all, it was the first work of science fiction ever to appear on the New York Times trade paperback bestseller list, where it remained for more than 5 months. He's written 30 more best-selling novels, sold more than 30 million copies in the U.S. alone. He's in his 70s, and he has a new novel called High Druid's Blade coming out in July. But today...
Today, he's in Eureka Springs.
How cool is that?
Yes, this is part of the Books in Bloom.
And that's amazing. This is the ninth year, which also amazes me because it seems like it was just a baby. It's a project of the Carolyn Madison County Public Library Foundation, and it brings in all kinds of authors as part of the May Festival of the Arts in Eureka Springs. Brooks is going to speak at 3:30 today on staying relevant at 70, mm-hmm. which probably some of us ought to start thinking about in the next 20 years or so. But he answered some questions for us for What's Up. And my favorite, I asked him, what advice would you give aspiring writers? He said 10 words.
Okay.
Read, read, read. Outline, outline, outline. Write, write, write. Repeat. He said, or I could tell them to be patient with themselves and remember that writing is a craft and it takes time to learn it. So, the whole Books in Bloom event is free. It also includes Mark Crist
mm-hmm.
and Kat Robinson
mm-hmm.
and herbalist Stephen Foster. And it will be a great day. It starts at noon today at the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. All sorts of things going on. Or if you're in Fayetteville, the Block Street Block Party starts at 11 with music by Cletus Got Shot, Candy Lee, Leah and the Mojo Doctors, Isaiah's All-Stars.
So many more.
Shaky Bugs. You name it, they'll be there. And that is all free.
Right.
I'd like to save you money. Please donate to my moving fund.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. There are no official boundary lines for what is called the Bible Belt. It's generally agreed, though, that the Ozarks, the Ouachitas, all of Arkansas, exist in a region where religion and faith are important influences on almost every aspect of everyday life. With this in mind, we launch a series of conversations on this edition of Ozarks about faith. Clint Schneckloth is lead pastor at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville. He's also the author of the book Mediating Faith, Faith Formation in a Transmedia Era. For our first conversation about faith matters, we discussed, among other things, the diversification in this region that's developed in recent years.
I've been interested in this basically ever since we moved to the region, which was a little over 3 years ago. But what's fascinating to me is to hear people tell stories about the transitions that are happening in the religious landscape, especially like, say, in Fayetteville, but really that's also regional, because you have, the Islamic Center that's been built on the university campus mm-hmm. here recently. You have
Temple Shalom.
Shalom is relatively new, and that's a new and really growing Jewish community. And if you talk to the Jewish community, for example, they'll talk about the transitions and the growth of Judaism within the South, which is interesting, you know. And then that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of some of the developments and changes that are happening in the area.
I'm wondering, where you grew up, was there a large diversity of faith?
Well, where I grew up, there were some dominant Christian traditions, but they were different than here. In fact, I joke with people here. So I grew up on a farm outside of Eldridge, Iowa, and in Eldridge, there were no evangelical or Baptist churches. That area was settled primarily by German immigrants in the 19th century who were all either Lutheran or Roman Catholic. So those are the two biggest traditions in that part of the country. It was like the Lutherans and the Catholics. And then when I was in junior high, this would have been like, say, the early or mid-80s, there was a Baptist church plant in Eldridge. And an increasing number of my classmates were part of that community because Eldridge was starting to diversify a little bit. People were coming from other parts of the country to the area. Like here, there were some big industries mm-hmm. that were drawing employees like Caterpillar and John Deere and that kind of thing. And but I honestly didn't know that much about Baptists or evangelicals growing up. From direct experience, it was more how dominant they are in terms of the Protestant landscape nationally. You know, you can't go to the Christian bookstore without it being primarily
right.
Evangelical or whatever.
So if faith touches so many of us and it's all about us, it still seems it's something that many of us are anxious to talk about, especially if we're going to talk about it with someone who might not share our particular background or faith. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think that I just read this quote yesterday I really like. it's a little scary, too. There's a Elizabeth Drescher, who is a kind of like a religion analyst and professor of communications and religion, summarizing some data from the Pew Foundation, said Catholics are leaving the church because they're hurt. Evangelicals are leaving the church because they're angry. And mainline Protestants are leaving the church because they're bored. Which is this kind of fascinating, like, mix. So when you talk to people who come from different traditions, what I notice anyway is those kinds of things play out. So, like, there are some people raised fundamentalist who would really rather not talk about religion at all because it's almost like they have post-traumatic stress disorder. And, like, the whole experience they had growing up in that tradition was so hard for them that they don't want to have the conversation. Or you'll have, like, lapsed Catholics who have been hurt by some of the things that have happened in Roman Catholicism. You'll have mainline Protestants who are just kind of apathetic, and they're like, yeah, I used to go to church and whatever. So I personally, I find kind of there's a range. There's some people who really would rather you didn't bring it up. Maybe they've simply been evangelized too much or whatever. The wider cross-section, once they have decided that you seem like a relatively safe conversation partner, you know, you're not going to, like, lead them down the path to
whatever.
Right, yeah. Whatever. Then there's some fascination, curiosity. People will ask each other questions about their tradition, that kind of thing. Yeah.
That's interesting because I was thinking about it coming from the other way, that I wouldn't want to get into a conversation with someone because I wouldn't want to offend them by something I said that might offend them because they don't believe the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to protect them from my thoughts.
Yeah. My basic philosophy on that as a pastor is, the way I describe it is I practice what I'd call open confessionalism, which means I think it's actually healthy and good for me to be transparent about what grounds me, where I'm coming from. But that doesn't mean that I have to that I have any kind of responsibility to, like, convert you and make you come into the confession that I'm a part of. If I describe my confession well, like if I describe my faith well and I live it well, maybe you'll be attracted to it. But that's ultimately not my role. But I think I don't have to, like, the open part is I don't have to kind of protect you from it as long as I'm grounded in a healthy way. And
that makes sense.
And then there are, I think there's increasing numbers of people in all religious traditions who are trying to practice that. Who, you know, we have some groups here in Fayetteville that try to be intentional about gathering people from a wide set of religious traditions.
There's an interfaith day that happens at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, right?
Exactly. I'm good friends with a couple of the members over at Temple Shalom, and they'll invite us to come to some of their religious observances. They come to ours periodically, and there's not a philosophy of, like, we're trying to, you know, get the temple members to become Lutheran, or, you know, the temple isn't trying to convert the Lutherans to Judaism, but more of, like, we can be strengthened by understanding each other better. And in fact, some like, say, theologians who work in the area of comparative theology say you really start to understand your own tradition best when you engage another tradition. If you're just kind of hunkered down in your own, you don't even understand yourself very well. So the, you know, coming to the other and having that engagement actually deepens your own faith.
Do you have a hope for what people leave after one of your sermons feeling called to action, better about themselves? Is there a goal? And that may be so ambitious if you're doing it 52 Sundays a year.
Uh-huh. One of my favorite ways of thinking about the sermon is to say that the sermon actually isn't done when I get done delivering it, but it's where it, how it plays out among the congregation in some way in their life. And so my when I know that a sermon has done something, you're often, first of all, you're often surprised. Sometimes the sermon you thought was just amazing, you get nothing back, you know, and you're like, it feels like it went thunk. And you're like, why did that happen? And then you have some other sermon that you think is like a complete mess. And you think like, oh, man, that didn't do anything for anybody. And then you'll go home and you'll see like a flurry of posts on Facebook. And they're like, after the sermon today, I was really thinking about whatever. Or somebody will send you a note or mm-hmm. call you. And so, first of all, that's always a surprise. But what I really – I would say if I have a hope, it's essentially that it opens up kind of – the active engagement on the part of people so that they're carrying their faith into their daily walk in a way that keeps them curious and talking. And I think that if they're doing that, like if they're still kind of considering something from the sermon on Sunday morning, on Sunday evening, and they're talking about it at the dinner table, there's some pretty good chance that it's also going to impact then maybe how they relate to somebody differently at work Monday morning.
Clint Schneckloth is lead pastor at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville and author of the book Mediating Faith, Faith Formation in a Transmedia Era. Our conversations about faith and faith-related topics will continue on Ozarks at Large over the coming weeks and months. If you have comments or suggestions about this series, you can send us an email to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. That's ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
As summer nears, the warmer weather takes me back to summers past, a time when I was barely 16, driving country roads with the windows down, music blaring, and a car full of friends. One of my favorite artists that I stumbled upon at the age of 14 was Aubra Moore, a folk rock singer-songwriter whose 1995 second album, Strangest Places, spent much time in my Walkman. The CD was light blue, which also happened to be my favorite color. As I have more than doubled in age since I first began listening to Aubra Moore, that first album has found its way back into my car, though I now listen through the Bluetooth capabilities of both my Subaru and my iPhone. An aspiring hippie, I was drawn to Moore's long hair and flowing dresses. Having grown up in Hawaii, she had the carefree air of a beach girl. With a jazz musician for a father, she was a founding member of the band Poi Dog Pondering, a world-renowned acoustic folk group in the late 1980s. The band moved to Austin, and though Moore left Poi Dog to pursue solo projects, she remained in the musical city, where she caught the ear of Sarah McLachlan, also a favorite of mine in the late 1990s. Moore performed with Lilith Fair, mirroring the sensuous songs of McLachlan. Music mogul Clive Davis discovered Moore shortly after and produced Strangest Places on his label Arista Records. The song Four Leaf Clover from the album made its way to the top 40 airwaves and video channels, and Moore even earned a Grammy nomination for Best Female Rock Vocal Performance. The up-tempo yet sometimes mellow beat makes me want to lay out a blanket in the park and spin in dancey circles with a friend. The lyrics address a life less than ideal, one that is busy and complicated, yet she's done with it all and sees promise in the form of a four-leaf clover. It's as if she's realizing that the busy lifestyle is getting her nowhere, and now she's taking time for herself. The song I Don't Feel Like Crying made it to the Sliding Doors soundtrack, where she joined the names of Dido, Jamiroquai, and Elton John. The movie stars Gwyneth Paltrow, who alternates between two worlds, one in which the character makes it through the sliding doors and onto a train, and one in which the doors close just before she enters. Though many of Moore's songs are dreamy of love and optimistic of finding that whimsical romance, this song tells the story of running into an ex-lover, one that she has gotten over.
Is that you? Looks like you've changed.
Moore's work has been heard in more than 25 other films and TV shows, such as Cruel Intentions and Melrose Place. While most of the songs on Strangest Places are quick and almost chirpy, Happiness is slow, beginning with just the notes of a piano, soon to be joined by Moore's guitar and a light drum. I remember listening to this song as my first serious boyfriend and I were having troubles after an argument inside his Jeep Wrangler. The lyrics sound as if it's Moore's first breakup as well. But when it comes to breakups, they often all feel fresh, no matter how many times you've been through them. In Happiness, Moore wears a mask in life. But in this song, she's able to unveil that the happiness she pretends to have in daily life isn't real, breaking free of those that might be telling her to buck up and deal with it.
And I try to explain to myself, but I can't find.
In 2004, shortly after the death of her father, for whom she cared in his final days, Moore released the album Everything Changed. Her picture on the album cover aging little from Strangest Places, though almost 10 years later. In 2007, Moore released On the Way, an album that until now had yet to catch my attention. The mood is much more somber and the songs slower. Entertainmentvine.com called it extremely mellow and enjoyable. A long, sunny cruise on a hot summer day, which I had yet to read when I began writing this review. Her voice is still soft and sweet, but a bit more womanly. The track Sorry has a jazzy feel that perhaps came from her roots and her father. She is still atmospherically romantic, but is now a bit more seductive.
If I could hold you, I would. If the whole world would just stop turning and be real still. I said I'd meet you after midnight. I know I never did return.
Much different from the 1995 album that drew me to Moore nearly two decades ago, the song Sugar Right from On the Way is one that just might tempt me to roll down my windows and drive this summer. Until then, I'll meet her in that strange place with this song, Say It Like That.
Say that you like that, say that you would, say you will.
There's little sign of Moore these days, but her albums can be found on Amazon.com and iTunes. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Doing anything special today?
I am, actually. Today will be my wedding anniversary for the rest of my life.
A year from today will be your first wedding anniversary.
It will.
Congratulations.
Thank you, yeah.
Very happy for you and Sam.
It's exciting.
And there's no reason for you to be here, you should, but you wanted to come in and
I did. I mean, we're very dedicated to our work here.
Yes, we are. So, in honor of your nuptials just hours away, I put together today's montage about weddings.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. We really love you.
I, Laura Weber Baldwin.
Take thee, Lucas Lorenzo Spencer.
Take thee, Lucas Lorenzo Spencer.
To be my lawful wedded husband.
If there is anyone present who knows why this pig and this frog should not be joined in matrimony, let him speak now or forever hold his peace.
Soul, I always will, and in your voice I hear a choir of carousels. Carousel. But am I ever gonna hear my wedding bell?
In the presence of family, friends, and loved ones, for the purpose of uniting in matrimony,
all I could think of was the part I had to play. Then suddenly I went blank. I had one line and I couldn't remember it. When the Reverend said, "Who presents this woman?" was I supposed to say, "That's me?" Or was it, "I do?"
You knew your calm, a silvery day. A Swiss Alp as the sun grows fainter. Your Loch Lomond when autumn is the neighbor. Your moonlight on a night in Capri.
For the first time in my whole life, I realized I totally and utterly loved one person. And it wasn't the person standing next to me in the veil, it's the person standing opposite me now, in the rain.
Is it still raining? I hadn't noticed.
Love, I see you there. Adrift on the air, floating by the open window. Ah, the sentiment of love, reflections that speak of what can.
To see how you did on our wedding montage, go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
And nobody tried to read any secret messages into those, like, oh, that's what he thinks of the wedding. I mean, they were just different scenes and right. songs about weddings.
I suggested a couple of my favorites.
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
The Artisphere Festival Orchestra, featuring more than 80 musicians from around the world, returns to Northwest Arkansas for a series of music events in May and June. Two concerts will take place at Walton Arts Center, including American Crossroads on May 31st and Scandinavian Masterworks on June 6th. Tickets and full lineup available at 443-5600 or waltonartcenter.org.
Support for KUAF comes from Greenhouse Grill, featuring a seasonal menu of organic, locally grown produce and all-natural meats, plus organic beer and wines. Brunch and live music each Sunday until 2. Located at 481 South School in Fayetteville's Mill District and on the web at greenhousegrill.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Belfont.
Belfont.
In Boone County. Makes me think of Wedding Belfont.
I was going to ask. All right. Well, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
You'll be back tomorrow.
I will. All by my lonesome.
You will. Antoinette is returning from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm taking the day off to spend with my new husband.
You should.
Sounds crazy. Everybody have a good Sunday.